मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hi, this is episode 118 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray, recorded on the 14th of March 2021. I am Vikram Mohan, and over the next hour, Arnab will talk about recent news that the AICTE, I hope I got that right, they'll be removing math and physics as mandatory subjects for engineering. How well is this a good idea? Let's find out. Then, of course, the statement by Rutgers University defending Audrey Trushke. And, of course, would we even be a podcast about pop culture if we didn't ask Arnab to weigh in on Oprah's interview with Meghan Markle? All that and a lot more as usual. But first, let me take out a minute to tell you why I have not been on the podcast regularly of late. As you remember, we took a break in January because that was going to be a challenging month for my family due to many reasons, which I won't go into. But some good things happened as well. In my day job, I got promoted, which also unfortunately meant that I had way less personal time because of more responsibilities at work. And this left me with very less time to take care of all that was needed outside of work, including family, hobbies, and podcasting, where, you know, apart from recording, there's a whole bunch of time which goes into editing it, post-production, publishing, and all of that. So I am kind of still trying to, fit my schedule around, rather come up with a new schedule for me, which will help me hopefully do everything that I was doing. But in the meantime, I do miss being part of it, certainly. And I will try to be part of this whenever I can and whenever Arnab is happy to have me. But enough about me. Let's get in your host since we do have a lot to talk about. Hey, Arnab.
Hello, Vikram. So when you said you have a promotion, the first thought that came into my mind was, well, are you running as a TMC candidate? It seems everybody has that promotion now. So.
But here's the thing. I don't know. I mean, you need to be a member of the animal kingdom, right? I mean, either a reptile or a mammal. So the cobras...
Unless that's only if you're the superstar candidate and the putative chief ministerial candidate. If you have Yashwant Sinha, who's obviously, he's, you know, the bar is low, as I had said, as I tweeted, that, you know, this just goes to show the progress that Bengal has made. Because previously, people left Bengal because of lack of opportunities. Now, people are coming into Bengal because of lack of opportunities. So, wow.
What a turnaround. I mean,
yes.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Arnab, before we go into the main things, I'm a tech geek, right? And usually I look forward to reviews of new gadgets and, I read up on what they call as hands-on early reviews and all. But I want to ask you for hands-on early review of not a gadget, but of Republic Bangla. I was really, honestly, quite excited to see what exactly is the media angle, what's the marketing angle. How does it work? Does your namesake come up at 9 p.m. every day? Is he going to be the face of the channel going forward, long term? How has it been?
So before we talk about Republic Bangla, it's important to talk about a movie which was released in the 90s called Dalal, which had Mithun Chakraborty.
Chad Gaya Upar Re.
Yes, Chad Gaya Upar Re also had a Bengali. So this was one of the rare movies. In those days, what used to happen is that usually Mithun Chakraborty movies, at least the big release ones, used to have a Bengali translated dubbed version of it for the Bengali audience. So Chad Gaya Upar Re has a Bengali version, which is sung by Bapi Lahiri. And if it is possible that there is a song which is even more vulgar than the original, it's the Bengali version. Because it's just some of the words that are used. Some of the words are just, and most of it is actually terribly Hindi translated lyrics because they obviously can't rhyme it because it's been written in Hindi. So they have to use the Hindi words. So it's a hodgepodge of terrible Hindi and Bengali. But some of the words that are used, like for instance, the use of the word gotot, it's a word which is, again, it's just that the image that it conjures. Now why am I talking about this? Because, of course, with respect to, my mind is full of Mithun Chakraborty. And, the moment I hear anything about this, it just totally takes my mind away from that. But, and again, I since my mind was taken, what was the original question you asked again?
on, Early review of Republic.
Early review of Republic. Okay. So the vulgarity is still there in my mind. So Republic Bangla is exactly like that. It's this basically Hindi trans. It's the Republic Bharat's Bengali translation in the same vein of, you know, Gutur Gutur being translated into Bengali. It's an identical copy.
Do you
of
remember
Republic
what
Bharat.
Gutur Gutur was in Bengali?
No, this was Gutur Gutur. For sometimes it was Bokum Bokum, which is yeah, it was called Bokum Bokum, and so it basically the template is totally Hindi, but there are certain words in it which are Bengali, and you can recognize Bengali in it. And the reason why I say it is because of Arnab Goswami's Bengali. Arnab Goswami is obviously not a native Bengali speaker, so when he
something
talks,
which many people don't realize, right?
Yes, he's from Assam. So when he talks, it seems like this is basically Siri reading out Google Translate. So there are words in Bengali, but they don't really follow the proper construction of Bengali. This is not a way in which Bengali is spoken by any native speaker of Bengali. But it's funny. And firstly, I think that, you know, no matter what you may think of Arnab Goswami, I think this is a world record that anybody has shouted in the same volume in three different languages in the world. I mean, we have Bill O'Reilly, but he can only shout in one language. I mean, in a world, in anywhere in the world, it's usually one language. In India, we've stretched it to two. Arnab Goswami has stretched it to three. And this is rather unique. I'm pretty sure that there's an Assamese channel he can start and make it for. So I totally applaud him for his his trilinguality at this point of time. But with respect to your specific question, I haven't seen a lot of Republic Bangla. I've seen a few clips of Republic Bangla. It's the same as Republic Bharat with, you know, stilted Bengali on the part of Arnab Goswami. This is very plainly.
Is he still the showrunner?
I haven't seen the Sourav Ganguly interview.
Okay.
No, I haven't seen the Sourav Ganguly interview, but I saw one of the few clips of, because I'm not too hot on seeing yet another synthetic interview. And with Sourav Ganguly's interview, from what I've heard, and I saw a bit of the clips of Sourav Ganguly's interview. It was basically Arnab Goswami basically trying to get him to say, you know, if he's joining the BJP, and, you know, Sourav Ganguly kind of doing a kind of a Sharmila Tagore thing, you know, I have the towel here and I'm not going to say chunana, chunana. That kind of stuff is going on. So there's this, I know this is a disturbing image, but bear with me for a second. So I wasn't particularly, and I use the word with full understanding of its import, particularly excited by, you know, the prospect of Arnab Goswami interviewing Sourav Ganguly. But I've seen some of Arnab Goswami's debates, and I struggle to call them debates, and I'm pretty sure the ancient Greeks would be shocked if they saw what debate has come down to. But it was a standard fare for anybody who follows the whole Republic brand. But I think it's interesting in the sense that it just goes to show how seriously the BJP is treating Bengal. Because as I had tweeted last time, that, you know, the same day they were unleashing Mithun Chakravarti and Arnab Goswami. This is like, you know, this, you know, the Battle of Helm's Deep, when you have the Urukai.
The Kraken.
And, you know, these are the two biggest Urukais that, you know, the BJP can bring up. And they're launching them on the same day at, you know, and of course, the TMC is kind of holed up in Helm's Deep. And man, Arnab Goswami, the channel, this whole, I mean, I would be interesting to see what the future of this channel is after the Bengal elections is over. Because I can't think why commercially, if you take out the political backing from Republic, why would anybody want to start a Bengali channel? Because, you know, Bengali media, in terms of, you know, its revenue, whether it be movies or it's minuscule. It is minuscule. It's embarrassing. It's laughable. So if you're in the business just to make money, then you should be investing in Tamil channels or Telugu channels. You shouldn't be investing in any content which is focused for the Bengali audience. And many Bengalis might feel offended at me saying this, but I say this, you know, with a tinge of sadness as a Bengali, that, you know, based on some of our political choices, we have been reduced to penury as a state. So there is really no market for anybody to come in, except for our votes, except for the electoral muscle that the population brings about. Except that, which is really why Republic Bangla exists, there is no real commercial reason for anybody to make media investments in Bengal as of today. And I say this with sadness.
No, but the channel would not just air in West Bengal. It's available to Bengalis worldwide. That's a population that's affluent reasonably.
Well, first of all, it's not as affluent as you would as any other religion, as in the region. So if if you look at Gujarati Americans, if you look at Telugu Americans, I mean, if you look at Bengali Americans, in contrast to Bangladeshi Americans, Bangladeshi Americans are much more entrepreneurial. So there are a lot of Bangladeshi restaurants, a lot of Bangladeshi businesses. There are very few East Bengal, which is Indian Bengali businesses, very few. And I mean, I'm not saying there aren't. If you want to find them, you should go to the Bongo Shambhalan, which is held every year in the US, and just look at the premium sponsors. But even the, you know, in order to make it to the premium sponsorship of Bongo Shambhalan, which is like the premier Bengali event of the year in the US, I'm pretty sure that the platinum level of sponsorship would be laughed at by the Telugu community in the US. That that's what's needed for to be a premium sponsor or platinum sponsor. That's what you need to pay in order to buy a ticket for our event. So in terms of money, in anything which involves even on the global stage, for instance, just if I was being serious about what I'm currently saying, is that the biggest market for Bengali content is now Bangladesh in terms of financial returns. And Republic Bangla obviously is going to draw, you know, a blank in Bangladesh, because this is an inherently political channel, so they're not going to get the Bangladeshi market. If they're only targeting the Bengali, West Bengal market, then I just don't see any kind of prospect for them post-elections. Before the elections, I understand that this is the BJP government's move to get to invest a lot of money into the media space in Bengal, given that the biggest media player in Bengal, which was Ananda Bazar Publications, is now squarely Trinamool Congress, because honestly, in any place they have realized Telegraph. So they understand that their meal ticket comes from being a lapdog of Trinamool Congress. So that's what they have become. Now, in the Bengal media space, there is not a lot of space for BJP-aligned media. So in terms of the elections, I think this makes perfect sense. I would be interested to see how this pans out after the elections. Yeah. I'm going to... I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't think it's going to last. I don't see how it can last. I'm pretty sure that Arnab Goswami will stop helming these shows. I think these Arnab Goswami himself, because Arnab Goswami's time is goddamn expensive. Yes. So I think that he will possibly delegate it to some flunky after the elections are over, and then after a year it will wind up.
All right. The first topic probably which we can start off with is about the math and physics being removed as mandatory subjects. So what I wanted to ask you is, if you remember, I think this happened 2020, let's give it a make it a wash, but when I say last year, I meant 2019. A similar news came out where the government proposed that Ayurvedic and, within quotes, homeopathic doctors can take a bridge course and, you know, be treated on par with qualified doctors. And this news that now math and physics might not necessarily be mandatory subjects for engineers. Do you see this as a disturbing trend? What's your thought on this news?
So I would say that both of them are kind of a little different. The first one that you said of homeopathic doctors being, you know, doing a bridge course and becoming, you know, the same as to use the term allopathic. I've never heard of this anywhere outside
India. Outside India, you're right. Yeah.
I don't even know it's a term. I think it's like homeopathic, allopathic. I think this is totally. I'm kidding. I'm pretty sure there's this origin for this, but I've never heard anybody in the US saying I'm an allopathic doctor. So with respect to this kind of parity, I think ultimately it comes. So this is again an interesting topic as to what is the role of the government in terms of regulating healthcare, in terms of, let's say, regulating drugs or regulating, you know, for me, and I know that I'll possibly lose all my audience above 60 years old, is that homeopathy is not really medicine in terms of the rigor. And this is not just
exactly, which is why I said, quote unquote, homeopathic doctors.
So with respect, and having gone to an homeopath myself, and again, nobody in Bengal in my age group would have been spared the experience of going to a homeopathic doctor. You know, they just don't meet. Again, I don't want to disrespect anybody, because ultimately it comes down to belief. And I think with respect to health, as I've been reading more and more, a lot of it is based on, which is the placebo effect, which is, you know, how much you want to believe that you're being cured. It's your mental strength. It plays a huge role in terms of positive outcomes. And that's a scientific fact. So in many things, you know, it's the positivity that you bring, the faith that you bring into your, so much of it, if you're, I mean, I totally get it. You know, sometimes, for instance, when I feel panicky and when I feel that my chest is hurting, am I having a heart attack? The thought of it starts paining my chest. I mean, I start feeling the chest ache because I'm thinking of it. Watching a movie, it's gone. The moment it's there, I start feeling, and the pain is real. It's not that I'm imagining the pain. So I realize that this pain is happening because I'm thinking about it. And so a lot of our pain and a lot of our ailments is a function of our brain. At least the symptoms are. And so I'm not going to knock systems which, I mean, if I'm cured by thinking that these white globules are medicine and it cures me, I don't feel the pain and it doesn't bring any side effect, then who am I to knock that? I mean, it works for you, it works for you. So again, with respect to homeopathy and allopathy, I feel ultimately it's something which is left to the person who's paying for the service. So there is, like, as an adult, if you go to a homeopathic doctor in this day and age, there's a conscious decision that you're taking, either because of cost or because you sincerely believe in that
fair
kind
enough,
of
but,
medicine.
The problem would be that I go to somebody who has taken a bridge course. Would I know whether that person is a qualified doctor or somebody who has taken a bridge course from being a homeopathic doctor?
No, I mean, as long as people clearly state that they practice homeopathic medicine, I think then the, exactly. After that,
yes.
I mean, after that, it's caveat emptor. So you as a consumer, take a conscious decision. And I also think that to go to that kind of practitioner, and that's a choice that you have. It's after all your own body, so you get to choose, you know, who you go to. And again, sometimes it's guided by cost. I mean, let's accept it. I mean, allopathic medicine, I can use the word, is stupendously expensive. So, you know, for me, that allopathic, homeopathic thing is a less of a concern for me than, because the engineer who you hire will not say, I'm a bridge course engineer. He's an engineer. That's it. I don't know maths. It's not going to be reflected. He's not going to have a different kind of GPA or his grade card won't be different colored. He's going to be a guy who didn't have maths, who took some kind of bridge course, which is what I heard that they will have to do, and then they become an engineer. This is absolutely insane. This is exactly the kind of, you know, for, can I use the word shit in without being with this tagged as an adult? So this kind of shit that has come to pass off as progressiveness in this day and age, where everybody gets a friggin' medal. No, you cannot be an engineer if you do not have formal mathematical background. And no, this is not because that, you know, every engineer uses mathematics in their daily life. No, mathematics isn't a question of, do you know rings, wheels, and group theory? That is, you know, very few people use it. It's the thinking. It's the most important thing in this world in education isn't the actual content of what you learn. It is the mental processes that are exercised by the act of learning it. So to take a gym example, when you are doing, you know, 10 or 20 reps of a strength training exercise, it's not really important what exactly you're doing, whether the way you're doing is an incline or straight. It's the fact that your muscle is having that, you know, it's expanding and contracting. Ultimately, it comes down to that. That's what's going to give you the tone. That's what's going to burn your fat. With respect to mathematics, that's the thing. This is nothing more than doing reps. So just like, for instance, the Indian cricket team enforces, and I think that's the right thing to do, enforces certain physical fitness criteria. Not so much, I would say, is that, so what happens if you can't do the yo-yo test? What happens if you can't do this? What does it prove? Does it prove that you can't play cricket? No. It proves that you don't have the discipline, the mental strength that the team requires in order to play the game. It's not whether you can run a kilometer in 8 minutes. If you run it in 9 minutes, who cares? If you can spin the ball, who cares? No. It's the fact that you don't put in that amount of effort in yourself as a professional sportsman to be able to meet this line. It says something about you as a person. You as your body and your physique. It's not the absolute magnitude which matters, which is why I support Ravi Shastri and Kohli's insistence on these parameters. Not because the parameters themselves are important, but because of what they show about the person who fails these parameters. It's the same thing about mathematics. Mathematics provides you a kind of structured training in terms of thinking. It provides you that logical, and if you're doing programming, if you're writing programming, if you're programming in Python or you're programming in C or Java, you don't need mathematics, you don't need the concepts, but you do need to have that regularized structured thinking. You need to have the attention span that lets you concentrate and lets you hold a thought, you know, just like it's like swimming. It's like you hold your breath under the water. You need to hold a thought. You need to be able to logically reason for about 30 to 40 seconds. And mathematics trains you to do that. Again, and so if you say that, look, I don't care if you did mathematics, if as long as you have something in biology or something, you're perfectly fine to be an engineer. Again, the thing is that you're not getting through the discipline that's needed in order to be an engineer, in order to be a scientist. And that's why physics and mathematics, both of these things, they train you to think in a particular way. So even if you're not using the concepts, and I agree, and I'm pretty sure that the people who did this, that is their logic, that nobody needs concepts of mathematics if they're going to be programming in Java for the rest of their life. And that's 100% true. But the fact is that you cannot be a good programmer until unless you have gone through or you have done that kind of structured thinking that's needed. So in physics, for instance, let's take the mathematics to the side. What happens in physics? So in physics, what happens is, you know, in any physics exam, you basically, if you remember your physics exams, you learn some certain kind of theory, let's say Newton's laws. And then there's certain problems which are presented to you. And given the difficulty of your physics test is essentially a measure of how directly those mathematical concepts relate to the physics that you learned. So for an easy physics test, they're straight off application of formulae that you learned. That's it. For difficult physics tests, the physics Olympiad, it's a very, very differently phrased problem, but it's not immediately obvious what those physics laws are that you need to apply. So you need to take a difficult problem, break it down into sub-problems, break it down into sub-sub-problems till you get to the part where you can solve. And if anybody who's ever programmed complicated systems. That's exactly how you do it. Any kind of complicated, it's not just a question of programming, even if you don't do programming. Any scientific problem, whether it be in biology, chemistry, or just industrial problems, or you know, that's ultimately how it works. There are certain basic principles, and these basic principles are not immediately observable in any complex real-life problem. And it is your intellectual ability, it is your worth as an engineer to be able to break down this very, very high-level abstract description of a problem into simple constituents, and then be able to look at best practices or to be able to look at laws, you know, in generally in life and in practical, there's nothing like Newton's laws, you know, which or Kirchhoff's laws that, you know, just apply it and the truth comes out. So there's always some kind of subjectivity everywhere. But it is this thing that an engineer needs to learn. And, you know, this is why it's, you know, another conversation where I'd, you know, in a previous podcast, I talked about my daughter learning programming. I say, I'm not so concerned about whether she knows programming per se. What I'm concerned, and this is the thing that, you know, early, you know, she's 8 years old. So this is what I want her. I'm not so concerned about the program she's writing, whether she, you know, whether she can do searching, sorting, or these things she will learn later. These are not important. Their habit is to sit in front of a computer, see if your program is going wrong, and to see how you debug it. The patience, the perseverance, that is what needs to be taught. These are the life skills. It's not C, Java, COBOL. None of this matters. These will all change. But perseverance, sticking to it, thinking, dealing with frustration. God damn it, it's not working. I need to, you know, I feel like crying, but I still need to solve this. These are the things which need to be trained. And these things can't be trained later on in life. Later on in life, you train it, it's more difficult to get these. So this the whole morning shows the day. These are the basic skills that you need. And anybody who you have children, you know, who's less than 10 years old, these are the things that you should be trying to inculcate into them. And later on, they can learn stuff. You know, learning stuff, it's a whole lifelong process. You know, that thing that, you know, many times when I was growing up, I don't know if you had this, Vikram, was, you know, a smart guy was the guy who at class 4 was doing the exercise of class 6.
Right.
That's not smartness. You know, that's, you know, what happens with that is those kids usually are the guys who never, nothing much ever happens to them in life. Because what happened is you basically ruined their childhood for them. And so they will try to live that throughout their lives. So it's not important that in grade 4 they do the grade 6 things. It's that during grade 4 they do the things that enable them to get, to build the habits that, I'll give you an example. I mean, one of the smartest guys I've ever known in my life, who's, you know, he works for Google now and yeah, must be making like a $2 million a year. The base, I would say.
Colleague of Wolf.
He's not Wolf. No, he's not Wolf. He's a real Wolf. So, you know, I grew up with this guy. And for years, when we were growing up and we were like working our butts off, trying to see who was first, who was second, he was nowhere. He didn't even bother with these things. He was a young kid and his parents figured that out. He was very good with music. You know, he used to play a lot of music. He was brilliant with music. And while most of us didn't realize what was going on, but the fact was that he was learning the skills that he needed to, you know, beat the shit out of us later on. But he was not learning it in the way that we were doing it. He wasn't worrying whether he was getting 48 out of 50 or 49 out of 50. Or he was an average guy for most of his school life. And then when the real stuff came in class 9, class 10, class 11, 12, he just went from here to here. He just amped it up. And then like people were like, you know, really, we were like pissing in our pants when we saw him. Like, how did this guy become this good? But the fact is now I realize, of course, he was building up to it all his life. And he just turned it on when it mattered. And that's the thing about this guy. This is why I think he's one of the smartest guys I've ever known. He doesn't sweat it when it doesn't matter. He just turns it on when it needs to be turned on. Otherwise, he's this most cool, casual guy who doesn't really care about what's happening. And when things matter, he just brings his A game and then he brings it down again. He doesn't try to maintain it. he does other things. So again, I'm pretty sure that there's something special about him. I think even if somebody tells me that, I can't be that. But I'm just saying that I've seen this guy and I've always been in awe of him. Anyways, so that's my the thing. I'm totally against it. And I'm against it. I think it comes from that you know, that kind of progressive ideal that, you know, everybody is beautiful in their own way and, you know, everybody gets a medal. But I'm sorry, in engineering, and this is the thing, you know, in and I see this sitting in the US and working as an engineer, that, you know, Indians, it's not just a question of specific people from India, but, you know, Indian firms. Maybe we don't produce an Apple, or, you know, because again, this is a conversation for another day, that innovation isn't just about product innovation. It's also about doing a mundane thing, but doing it at a cent cheaper than the other guy does it. That's innovation also. You know, those cents add up. So I see Indians doing amazing in terms of engineering. This is one of the things that we totally rock. I mean, as I said, it's not just a question. I think everybody does say it, and this is great for WhatsApp conversations, is look at the number of Indian CEOs in Microsoft, Google. It's not a question of the top guys. There's always going to be smart guys. I mean, you should never form an idea of any trend by looking at the best guys. You know, you shouldn't, you know, Sachin Tendulkar's and the Sundar Pichai's of the world can't be the way that we think about any problems. They're always outliers, they're exceptional outliers. But in general, in terms of general engineering skills, and give Nehru the praise for it or whoever, I don't care what the politics of this is. But it's just that there's nothing wrong with engineering education in India. Very little wrong. So this is again a case of somebody trying to fix something which is goddamn not broken. And there's a lot of shit which is broken in this country, but this is not one of the, you know, the engineering skills that, you know, students have. So I don't see why we even need to change this fundamental aspect of engineering education. No, you need mathematics and you need physics for the reasons that I just said.
No participation trophies here.
No participation trophies. And you will produce a generation of engineers who will have this lacuna. You'll produce worse engineers. Again, people will point to one person and say, well, what about this person? Now, that's the thing. Whenever you look at systemic problems or systemic good things, you just can't point at isolated individuals. Outliers. Now, look at this terrible guy. Look at this super guy. No. Look at the average guy. That's the person we're talking about. In any kind of quote-unquote engineering endeavor, there are always products which lie outside that limit. You know, whether it's when you're doing quality monitoring, your good engineering processes, which 99.9% of the time produces a product which lies within the parameters of quality. That's what a good process is. Okay. Doesn't mean then this shit doesn't come out, or doesn't mean that something totally amazing doesn't come out, but it's the average. We have to consider the average case. And I don't think that in the quality of the average will be improved by taking out mathematics and physics as a prerequisite for being an engineer.
All right. Should we talk about or is it Dr. Trushke?
Yes. Dr. Trushke. Definitely. Yes. We should definitely. So here's the thing. And again, I have particularly no. Again, as a centrist, as a person who wants to be true to principle, I personally find, I mean, I don't agree with Dr. Trushke's history and her historical interpretation, but I feel that she has the right to say them. As an academic, and this is the reason why academia is a protected place, is that as an academic, she has the right to be provocative intellectually. She has the right, and you might not agree with what she says. And the way to, you know, oppose an academic idea which you find offensive is to have another academic idea. And so this has always been the model from the, whether it be the ancient Greeks, whether it be, you know, ancient, you know, Hindu centers of learning, it was always debate, was always considered to be an academic prerogative, you know, non-personal intellectual debate. There were huge debates in ancient India between different strains of Hindu doctrine, Buddhist doctrine, and none of them led to, you know, kind of Arnab Goswami things. I'm pretty sure one, a few of them might have, but but the fact is that our centers of our universities, they fostered a sense of debate. And many of these ideas, and this is one of the things, and this kind of, and so this comes back to the question of principle. But over the past few years, progressives in America have whittled away at that. They have said, no, some ideas are not acceptable in the university. There needs to be safe spaces. So
before I get there, okay, though, one of the arguments against Dr. Troschke, one which I don't buy, is that she's an outsider. So don't talk about, for example, don't talk about Hinduism if you're not a Hindu. Don't talk about India if you're not an Indian. Don't talk about...
Yeah, we will come to that. First of all, let's take the attack on Dr. Troschke, because she's a white woman and she's not Hindu. This to me is objectionable. There is no limit on... And again, unfortunately, this is something which that the progressives have brought up. They've said that, you know, you cannot, you're basically appropriating another culture. You cannot talk about anything which is, so if you're a man, you can't talk about women. If you're not a Muslim, you can't talk about Islam. So, you know, this kind of exclusivity with respect to identity, this again, a communist Marxist concept, which has kind of been mainstreamized by the so-called progressive agenda, which I like to call the BuzzFeedization and Huffington Postization of traditional Marxist theory. So since I don't buy that bullcrap, I also feel that it's not a valid criticism to point to Andrew Troschke as a person, as if she was brown and Indian, what she said would be accepted because she was inside. No, it's not. What she says is objectionable, irrespective of who she is. So first of all, we should take out the who she is, who that person is. For me, as a centrist, the first thing in any kind of, and this is obviously when you're fighting among friends after having a few drinks, that's not true. Of course, the person who's saying it is important. But I'm saying this in the context of any kind of intellectual or academic debate, it's very important that you take out the personal character or the identity of the individual who's making the point. I mean, it's called getting personal. And unfortunately, the progressives have no problem in getting personal as long as it suits their agenda. But again, as not as a progressive, as a centrist, I would say, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who Dr. Troschke is. Many people point out, oh, Dr. Troschke is, you know, allied with some, you know, evangelization. I honestly don't care. It doesn't matter who Dr. Troschke is. What I want to look at is what she's saying. And again, I believe that as an intellectual, as a historian, as an academic, she has every right to say whatever she wants to say, whatever, however provocative or however triggering, you know, some Hindus may feel about what she's saying, which is basically the Hindu analog of Holocaust denial. That's what she's saying. She's basically saying that Aurangzeb was a good guy because he didn't kill every Hindu that he came across. It doesn't matter that he, you know, it doesn't matter what bad things he did. There were all these other good things that he did also, which again, you could apply it for any genocidal maniac in the world, even Hitler. So this fundamental thing is problematic to me. But again, somebody wants to make the point. If somebody has data, sure, they can make it. And this whole thing that, you know, with Rutgers is that Hindus are getting triggered by this. And so then Rutgers issues a statement which says, Hindus, we want to create a safe space for Hindus. But we also, so this is again, Rutgers is trying to, you know, hunt with the hound and run with the hare on this case, which that's why their response makes no sense. You can't have both. You can either say no. Dr. Trushke is absolutely free in an academic space to have provocative ideas. If you don't like it, don't take her class. Don't read her book. Don't follow her on Twitter. If you find, and that's that I find is absolutely fine. That's the way I like to treat things. But no, for everybody else, they have academics who have to temper what they're saying based on the sensitivities of the audience. This is what has come to be expected in American academia as of today, that everybody needs to have a safe space, nothing that could be considered. And so provocative, which means that virtually everything can be provocative, right? I only need to take offense at anything that you have said. I just need to have a sufficient number of followers, a sufficient number of influence to get 5 other people to agree with what I said. So even if you didn't believe, even if you'd never thought of this as an offense, if I convince you that this is offensive, you will be convinced. Everybody wants to be offended. Everybody wants to, because there is a certain sense of, it's kind of like self-soothing, like when we sit and we keep our elbows closed. You know, people say that's because, you know, this is a body language which shows that this person is kind of close to ideas. No, that's not true. It's just that you're self-soothing. You're basically hugging yourself at that point of time. So everybody likes this notion of that they're being victims. I like this notion myself, of course. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm any different from any individual. But the very fact that you're in an academic environment should say, you know, academia is like being in an intellectual war field. It's in an intellectual battlefield. I mean, if you can't take the heat, stay out of the kitchen. If you can't take the war of ideals and wars of thoughts, don't be a part of an academic environment. Work in industry. Industry, I understand. Everybody has to be very careful in everybody's sentiments. Why? Because we are forming teams and we work there for the pure generation of profit. That's the reason why industry exists. It's a profit-making exercise. Academia is the main thing about academia. And again, that line has also been diluted over the years. That academia exists not to make money, but because it is responsible for ideas. So as an academic, just because I find, and many other Hindus find, what Dr. Trushke says, to be offensive doesn't mean that first she should be canceled, doesn't mean that she doesn't have the right to say what she does. We have a choice not to engage with her. It's as simple as that. However, the point over here is, this is increasingly what I find to my dismay, is that those who are not progressives, even when this Hindu association is writing about complaining about Dr. Trushke, ultimately they're adopting the very techniques of the progressives. They're adopting that whole cancel culture thing. It's just that they couldn't make it work because of the power that Dr. Trushke and, you know, like-minded individuals have over American academia. But it doesn't really matter. It's that what matters is that you're using the same kind of techniques. This person is saying something which is, and so there comes these offensive to certain classes of people, and this could be anybody. And so let's silence that person. This is cancel culture in its, you know, the classic expression of what cancel culture is. And cancel culture, again, I've discussed this previously in my podcast. If you have studied the history of Soviet Russia and China, this is, cancel culture is inherently a part of what was the first part of any kind of purge. So any kind of purge in a communist regime is that your compatriots, they denounce your ideas. They say, look, this person is an enemy of the people. This person is an imperialist spy. Let's cancel the guy. So again, in communist Russia, in China, in Cambodia, cancellation usually meant being sent to a gulag or, you know, being forced into forced labor. Nowadays, since it's not a communist country, it's basically you lose your job, you lose your social standing, you lose your whatever intellectual influence you've had. That's what cancel culture is. So it's some would say it's no different than killing a person, as for many academics, perhaps they would perhaps prefer to be killed rather than their ideas to be buried. But I think people have realized that killing the person who's saying it actually makes their idea sometimes stronger. So the last thing you should do is, you know, send the guy to the gulag or, you know, torture him by pouring hot wax on his feet.
Right.
That's the worst thing you can do. So better is just to deplatform that guy. Just make sure that the idea is not hurt. Don't go after the person. Go after the idea.
Kill the idea, not the person.
Kill the idea. To kill the person, the idea becomes stronger. So this is something which the communists, the new communists, have realized. That, you know, it wasn't that we were doing things wrong, fundamentally, ethically wrong. It was just that we were trying to kill the wrong thing. So now let's kill the right thing and make sure that people are scared. So the main thing is to the whole notion of a chilling effect was that once you send sufficient number of people to the gulag or you shot them down in public, then, you know, people would be immediately the others. And you can't ultimately in the country, you know, how do authoritarian regimes work? If you look at it to a purely logical way, how many communists, how many people in KGB were there? If the Russians all decided together that we will overthrow them, there's nothing that they could do. The ruling class is going to be numerically less than the people that they terrorize. And if the people that terrorize all get together and say, no, we're not going to be terrorized anymore, you know, there's really nothing those guys can do. I mean, how many guys are you going to shoot? You're going to run out of bullets before people come and stab you. So you can't, this is something which you can't win. So how does it work? It works by scaring. It works by making sure that you don't know that if you go and revolt, whether the guy next to you is going to revolt. You don't know if that guy belongs to you or the guy belongs to the other side. That's why nobody wants to take the first step. This is exactly how authoritarian regimes all over the world, and there is nothing and there is no philosophy which is more authoritarian and hateful than communism. And this is how they have always worked. And this is exactly an extension of what you know, cancel culture is. You make sure that a few people are publicly shamed and deplatformed, and you know, pretty much everybody else will be scared. They won't say anything. Not because they don't feel it, but because they'll be scared of the consequence of what will happen. It's not going to be that they're going to be shot in the streets, but that's not the worst thing that you can do to a person. Sometimes it's the best thing you can do to a person. So that's really what has happened in terms of cancel culture. And with the kind of political bias that some of the social media platforms have shown, like Twitter, and, you know, this cancel culture is now almost institutionalized.
Right.
It's not a question of just, oh, I said something, 10 other people said something. It's not a question of symmetric warfare anymore. It's a question of you as an individual allied against the politics of these tech giants. So, and these tech giants are way more powerful than any country or any empire this world has ever seen. So, you know, in terms of the asymmetry is huge. But coming back to Dr. Trushke, I don't favor cancellation of anybody, no matter for what their opinions are. And that's even more if it's in an academic space. So I'm disappointed by the people who are arrayed against Dr. Trushke, basically adopting the methods of Dr. Trushke. But there is also no doubt that in terms of her historical interpretations, they're, again, they're in her interpretations. She says she has every right to write books. She's an academic. She's every right to be provocative. She obviously has facts, some facts. Now, there could be selective facts. But again, the response to Dr. Trushke should be a takedown of her ideas. Now, this is where you'll find that Rutgers will not provide the platform to the guy who will take down her ideas. That's also true. See, that is where the problem with Rutgers is. It's not that Rutgers comes out with this inane statement saying that they want to create a safe space for Hindus. It's not that Dr. Trushke is creating an unsafe space for Hindus. She's not promoting, you know, attacks on Hindus in any sense of the term. So there I will support her. What she's saying is she's essentially doing kind of Hindu Holocaust denial. She's basically, it's not, again, this is, somebody would say, well, you're using the exact same kind of provocative language. Yes, I am. I don't think she's also doing, he's basically trying to find nuance in somebody who did genocide. And that's true for many historians. You try to find, you know, it's just some nuance than that. Well, guess what? In either you decide that it's perfectly fine for historians and academicians to find nuance in bad people, or you say no, once a person has been proven to be bad or hasn't killed a huge number of people, trying to find nuance is nothing but being an apologist for that person. So you decide either on this or you decide on this, but once you decide, you have to be consistent.
Right.
That's the thing as a centrist. Both of them are perfectly valid worldviews. You can decide, okay, I am, as a historian, as an academician, my provocation or my challenge to the world is to take somebody who is a villain, who's everybody, all of us agree is a villain, who did some terrible things. Try to find, you know what? He did some good things. For instance, if somebody writes in academia that, you know, Hitler, you know, he did some good things. You know, he basically took a country which was devastated by World War I and he made it into a that's a terrible thing to say. I would say that's a very provocative and terrible thing to say, because it doesn't, because this, for me, my worldview, this is a justification. This is a way to make Hitler look good. In the same way, Aurangzeb is no different from Hitler. It's just many years ago, but in terms of the people he killed, in terms of his worldview, and when I say Aurangzeb, I'm just talking about him. I'm just talking about the entire line of Mughal emperors. Now, I also understand there's a nuance. You know, we're talking about people in the Middle Ages. You know, it's the Middle Ages for a reason. It's called medieval for a reason. So it's not particularly helpful to take, you know, our worldview in the 21st century and try to, you know, fit it on the Middle Ages. So all of these things remain. I absolutely understand that. And it's perfectly fine as a part of evaluation of Aurangzeb to bring them out, to say, you know what, sure, Aurangzeb did this, but this was par for the course. And this is fine. Again, as an academic, if I find all of this offensive, which I do, I personally do, as a Hindu, I personally find this offensive. I don't read her. I mean, I've read some of her articles and I've realized that this is not a person who I want to deal with. Where she's coming from, she comes, the way I see it, I'm not going to assign intentions on, you know, why she's doing it or the, you know, who she is, or I'm not even concerned about, you know, the person. But from where I'm coming from, she's trying to say that a person who killed my forefathers for who they were, not because of what they did, because of who they were, also did some good things. Which means what really? What's the point here? Of course, any politician, whether it be Pol Pot, did Pol Pot kill everybody who he came across? No. Did Idi Amin kill everybody he came across? No. So of course, there's nothing new about this, that politicians, despots, genociders, they will make strategic alliances. They will, but that doesn't mean that they are not driven from a sense of hatred. That doesn't mean anything. It just means, oh, Aurangzeb one day saw a little beggar and gave him a rupee. Okay, that's good to know. How does that change my thought? Why is that even relevant? I don't know. It's like saying, I mean, would anybody, you know, forget everybody, you know, would any of the liberals of the US say, you know what, Donald Trump, you know, you hate him, but you know, in Home Alone 2, he was a good guy. Yeah, that's true. That's objectively true. But that doesn't change anything about Donald Trump and his legacy. It doesn't. So as an historian, you're free to point that out 200 years later, 300 years later. You know, but if you point that out, it's perfectly fine for people to also think that you're trying to humanize, you're trying to apologize for what Donald Trump did. I'm not saying Donald Trump did, you know, is anywhere close to anywhere close to an
origin. Right, exactly.
I'm not. Again, other people have said, you know, he's Hitler and stuff. But again, I'll be very careful about these kind of, you know, comparing people. Which, to...
You did cover, for our listeners, you covered cancel culture in episode 115.
Yes. So again, you know, comparing anybody with Hitler, I've always said, you know, one should be very careful when making these comparisons, because you have making these comparisons with people who are nowhere close to him, you run the risk of basically reducing the magnitude of what he did. The same thing with Aurangzeb. You know, what Andrei Trushky and she's not the only person, they do is they basically reduce the magnitude of what he did. And for me, again, as I said, he's free to do that. That's what academic, you know, debate is. Within the confines of the academic space, that's fine. And again, I don't think that she should be canceled for it.
Yep.
I'm dismayed by the fact that people who are opposed to the cancel culture in every other respect will take recourse to exactly the same instruments in order to silence somebody who they don't agree with or who they find offensive. So in conclusion, I find her ideas and I find her main thing offensive, but I also feel that she has every right to say it as an academic. And again, who she is, her name, her, you know, her classification as an individual is not germane to her ideas. She's an academic. Her ideas are independent of who she is as a person.
Which brings us to probably the thing that got the most press surprise. And I hate it each time this happens. But of course, we are of course talking about Oprah Winfrey's interview with Meghan Markle and her husband.
Yes.
So let's get to that. Did you see the interview? It's not
I've seen. So first of all, let me start off by saying that unlike many people, including my mother, who loves the royal family, obviously she's read so many biographies of Diana. I've never understood the fascination with the royal family, when Diana was alive. For me, again, I don't treat the royal family any different than I would treat Aurangzeb, to continue the previous story. The royal family has been responsible for, and they have had hundreds of years to do this. So as an institution, it has been responsible for some of the biggest genocides in this world. And the only reason why they have managed to survive and they have not been called into account for collectively, I'm not saying that, you know, point at Prince Philip and say he's responsible, but in terms of the House of Windsor, in terms of what they represent, they have caused more human suffering than any institution which exists in the world today and which is, you know, which has gone without any kind of accounting, which has gone without any kind of responsibility, forget prosecution. So in terms of the royal family, for me, I have always seen the royal family as, again, not again as an individual, but as an institution, one of the most problematic institutions in the world in terms of history. If you read history, you'll know what I mean. So I have no sympathies for the royal family. I have no interest in the royal family. Ultimately, when I was growing up, my whole impression of the royal family was it was just a very, very trashy family. A very trashy family, unlike, you know, Dark Dynasty, is just that they're British and they like to drink tea at 3 in the afternoon. So that's the only thing. They're just the royals. They're just friggin'ly rich people who have been rich, who from their Kohinoor diamond, everything that they have is because they looted it from somebody else. So they're like a mega mafia family with, you know, if mafia, you know, they, if Michael Corleone shoots one or two guys, they have shot millions. And they basically sit on the blood and flesh of millions.
And revered for it.
Yes, and they've never been prosecuted for it. They are, you know, again, they are, the way I look at it, they're evil. There's no doubt about it. In terms of anything associated with that family. Initially, the House of Windsor. Again, I want to distinguish between the persons and the institution that they voluntarily choose to belong to. So the institution is the criminal here. It's not the persons. Again, what did Prince Philip do? What did Queen Elizabeth do? Maybe nothing. They're too new. They, you know, they might look impossibly old, but still they are still a product of the era at which Britain was no longer the Britain of centuries ago. So they personally may not be held responsible. But again, they refuse to do the even the minimum amount. You know, even an apology for Jallianwala Bagh, they can't bring themselves up to say that. So this just goes to show that these people are, and this now it comes down to the people, that these are terrible people, privileged people, people that I have no interest in knowing about. Now, coming back to the interview. Now, the world is split into as to who is to blame here. And of course, it takes the familiar template of any Saas Bahu series, right? It's ultimately, you know, any marriage ultimately comes down to somebody from outside coming in and trying to see if they're a fit for the culture of another family. You know, two people who are, and when you have a culture like something which is so firmly entrenched and institutionalized, like the culture of the British royal family, this is you know, obviously, this is going to happen. It happened with, you know, Lady Diana. It's happening with Meghan Markle. And again, some people would say, but of course, she knew what she was getting into. She's now kind of monetizing that. So all of this has a reality show aspect about it. And that much of what she's saying is essentially, well, what did you expect? You didn't like, you went and put your finger in the fire and then you're saying, oh, but I got burned. I mean, what are you talking about? And all of this is true. And I, with respect to, you know, Piers Morgan and with respect to, you know, everything, I'm not so interested about that. But I'm more interested in something else, which I find fascinating, which is that one of the main things that, you know, when you observe anything, and this comes back to almost like Newtonian or reference frames, it's the sense that whether something is in motion or whether something is at rest depends on the reference frame that you're observing it from. So one way of looking at it is this thing, these are super rich people who don't have to work a day in their lives. And yet they're so unhappy and petty and they're always complaining, whether it be Meghan Markle or whether it be the royal family, doesn't matter. And we tend to look at it, and that's really where our sense of revulsion comes from, for those of us who feel revulsed by it. But seriously, is this their problem? Like, these people, I mean, they literally live off the blood of other people, and they feel that, I'm not talking about Meghan Markle, not the royal family in this case, and they feel injured and aggrieved. And with respect to Meghan Markle, you can think, well, she didn't know what she was marrying into the royal family. She didn't know what a curtsy was. What is she trying to tell us? But the point that I see is that it tells me something important. And again, something which I have realized over the past few years when I have thought about this more and more. I've tried to understand what happiness is. And I realize it's, you know, happiness and, of course, by extension, sadness. And I understand that it's not that these emotions that these people feel are not genuine. It's not that they're faking it. They genuinely feel sad. And just like it for us from this Newtonian reference frame, this seems to be so fake and so terrible and so, like, what the F for us? Our own problems are exactly the same for somebody from another reference frame. For somebody who has to struggle to put food on their table, our silly sources of sadness, I didn't get promoted at work, my romantic failures or whatever it is, that somebody who's struggling to put food on their plate, somebody who's sick. You know, these things, these sadnesses don't seem to be fraudulent also. But that doesn't mean that they're any less real or any more real for us who's feeling them. So just because you don't see me in motion and you think that I'm at rest because your frame of reference is moving in the same velocity as I am, doesn't mean that I'm not moving or I don't see that I'm moving. So my reality is my own. It's not that just because you think that reality, because you're from a different reference frame, and for the royal family, this is unique in the sense this is just one royal family, and everybody in the world is outside that reference frame. For us, it's not that exclusive. But all of us are in some sort of bubble where our little victories and our little sadnesses and our little injuries, I got trolled on social media, my friend unfriended me. These kinds of small things which hurt us and they're genuine seems trivial to somebody from the outside looking in. And that to me is more interesting, that notion as to how real are our griefs, how real is our happiness. That to me is more fascinating. And the only thing that Meghan Markle is, this is an extreme, extreme case of this one family that is the world's population minus one, which allows us to kind of study as an extreme example this kind of frame of referencing of what our sadnesses and what our senses of injury and, you know, oh, the world hasn't treated me right. I mean, that's really what the Oprah interview was. I mean, look at the, you know, God, you know, I'm getting $8 million for this interview. I am like friggin' rich. I'll never have to work a day in my life. Any door in the world is open for me. I can travel the world. And I'm so sad. I'm so sad. And you'll think, what? That's it. I mean, I'm not saying that Meghan Markle, and again, this comes to what Piers Morgan said. It's not that I'm saying that she's making it up. I think she genuinely feels so. And, you know, that doesn't mean that we can't find it to be a little bit off-putting, given the kind of real struggles that we go through in our world, to say, is this person's real problem? Yeah, it is. And again, there are other people who will look at us and say the exact same thing about our real problems that we find really real. It doesn't mean, you know, I was reading about this father from Syria. There was a picture about this father from Syria, you know, with a cart, with, you know, his daughter who's dead from bombing, you know, wheeling that cart. And, you know, look at that guy. And you think, well, if that guy looks at my problems, what is he going to think? I feel ashamed of even feeling bad about anything in the world when I look at this guy and say, my God. There's no difference between that person and I. He'd just be unlucky enough to be born in a country and born at a time where this has happened to him. What does he think about my life? Pretty sure he'll find my life in everything I say to be funny and fake, and he'll hate me for who I am. And I can't blame him for that. And that's exactly what the British royal family is, what those people are. For us, we are them. So that's, for me, is more interesting. Again, as I said, I'm not personally interested in the royal family, not interested I don't care for that family, and I'm not interested in their petty politics.
Did you sit through the entire thing?
I just watched some extracts of it. I was more interested in Mithun Chakraborty joining Trinamool Congress and you know, who else is going to be joining the Trinamool Congress, and why am I not joining the Trinamool Congress? These were the things that I was more interested in. And why haven't I been approached by any political party? Given that the bar is...
Would you want to make an appeal to Republic Bangalore to have you in one of those 47 boxes?
Yes, I don't understand why. Again, I'm shocked that, you know, with Bengal elections, Republic Bangla hasn't even asked me to occupy 2x2 inch of the television space. You know, the postage stamp size, you know, coverage that you get.
If you ever do, though, Arnab, you know, you might want to have a kind of a large chart sheet. Maybe your daughter can make one which says, with plugging this podcast, and you can just hold it up since anyway, there's not much you can do.
So, and again, with Mithun Chakraborty, I understand Mithun Chakraborty. I'm very interested. Last time when we recorded, I didn't know. I mean, I knew that Mithun Chakraborty was joining the BJP, but I hadn't yet heard his equating himself to a cobra.
Multiple times.
In another interview, he equated himself to a dog. He was asked questions about what his policies were and what he, and he just basically said, no, don't ask me. I'm not going to say anything. I have, again, this is one thing that I should straight off deal with the bat, that Mithun Chakraborty is somebody who's basically joined every political party in India. Now, as long as he was not aligned with the BJP, nobody had a problem with it. But now that he joined the BJP, he's become meme material. So this again goes to show dual standards. So if your question is that Mithun Chakraborty is somebody who really will go anywhere where he believes that his interests align with, that's a valid point to make. But you'd have made that point much earlier. You should have made the point when, you know, a Naxalite went to Mumbai, became close to Shiv Sena at a time when Shiv Sena wasn't this Shiv Sena, a time when Shiv Sena was like to the right of BJP, and then came back, you know, became a part of Trinamool Congress, and then now is coming back to BJP. So if your line of attack of Mithun Chakraborty is that he has no straightforward political ideology, it's a good point, but it's a point which you have made earlier. Second, much as I love the guy in terms of in every sense of the word, I really think that this is a terrible mistake on his part. All he's doing is I'm not even seeing what he's trying to achieve by doing this. Does he seriously want to be the chief minister of Bengal? Does he really have? I mean, see. Both, and this is again something which Trinamool Congress brought in, is they have a bevy of Bengal movie stars, and they increasingly they have upped the proportion. So initially the bar that you needed to cross in order to make it to Trinamool Congress heaven was, in terms of Bengal, moderately high bar. But now the bar has been reduced so that, you know, TV serial actors, people who may have appeared in one song, they're all Trinamool Congress and now by extension BJP candidates. So why is Mithun Chakraborty, who is a legend in his own way, why does he even want to rub shoulders with these people at all? Why? What is in it for him? And I understand none of these guys are there to serve the people. If you think so, then you're an idiot. For most of these second grade, third rung Tollygunge actors and directors, this is nothing but a way to get influence, make money. That's what it is. There's no doubt. And again, given the amount of money that you make from Bengali movies, which is pittance, you can't really blame them for it also. I mean, guy got to earn, right? So whether it be acting in a TV series or whether it be acting as a politician in real life, it's an acting gig, man. Now, I get it. I get it for some of the Trinamool Congress's 20 and 30-somethings people who will never be anybody. I mean, yeah, they might be an Instagram star for now, but in 5 or 6 years, nobody will care for who they are. They'll be replaced by another generation. And so I understand that trying to be a politician is an investment for them. Because as we know, as we've seen with Yashwant Sinha, but even if you're friggin' 80 years old, you're still in youth in Indian political terms. So unlike in the movies where, you know, you have not for everybody again, but you know, you have a sell-by date. In politics, it's like eternal. So I understand them becoming politicians, but what is Mithun Chakravarty trying to do here? And what is his game? What does he hope to get out of it? Is he looking to be the chief minister of Bengal? Why? In order for him to be chief minister of Bengal, does he seriously think that, as the BJP told him, that they want that he's being looked upon as a chief minister candidate? If they are, then the BJP, I'm seriously disappointed with the political acumen of BJP if they think that Mithun Chakravarty can be a chief ministerial candidate of Bengal. I would be shocked if that's what they think. I respect Amit Shah and his think tank a lot more than to think that they think that Mithun Chakravarty can be a chief minister of Bengal. He's just not the person to be a chief minister. And if the BJP is considering him to be a chief minister, as a huge fan of Mithun Chakravarty, I would unequivocally say to my listeners, for those who are voting, vote for Mamata Banerjee if he's the chief minister candidate. No question in my mind. If I was voting in the election, my vote would go to Mamata Banerjee. Just if Mithun Chakravarty, I love the man, love his movies, respect him for many, but he's not a chief minister. He's never been. He doesn't have the temperament. He's just not it. So is he going to be an MLA? He's not a list of candidate. Is he going to be the Rajya Sabha? Is he going to go to the Rajya Sabha? Why does he want to go to Rajya Sabha? I just don't get it, because now, Mithun Chakravarty might be an object of derision and fun and meme material, but for many of us, growing up, he was a big thing. So I kind of feel bad in a way. I kind of feel bad and kind of angry at Mithun Chakravarty in many ways for essentially trying to monetize his own legacy, because I kind of feel cheated by the very fact. I understand what he's trying to do in a way, but he wants to be relevant. I understand that. But you know, how is this helping him? Do Dance Bangla Dance, do Dance India Dance. I mean, that exposes you to a new generation of people. I understand that somebody like him, you know, adulation is important. Do all of these things. And you're a smart, intelligent guy with ability. So you can do a lot of things. I mean, there's a web series. There's a lot of things you can do. Why politics when you have repeatedly over the years shown that you have zero aptitude for it? You can't do it. You have no principles. And even when you were an MP of Trinamool Congress, he had zero impact as an MP of Trinamool Congress. Zero. He did zero for himself, for anything. It's just something like he ticks off on his resume and that's it. He forgets it. So why does he want to keep on doing it as he gets older and older? Again, when he was in Bombay, I understand that, you know, if you weren't close to Bal Thackeray, your movies would run into problems. So I get that. I totally get, you know, as a businessman, he has to keep everybody happy. I get that. As a Naxalite, I even get the fact that, you know, he was a young guy. It was fashionable to be a Naxalite in those days. And he genuinely believed in the ideals. I'm not going to say that's inherently dishonest. It's something he believed in. He went to Bombay, he became a business person, he became a megastar, and he then went and then he had to bow to the Mumbai ka king. He did it. All right. I get the pragmatic thing. I'm not a person who's particularly hung up on principle. Then he came back to Calcutta. You know, his Bombay career was over, his Ooty career was over. He came back to Calcutta. He did some movies. It's some MLA Patakeshto, Minister Patakeshto. He did some movies. I still got why he got into with Mamata Banerjee. Okay, all right, I get it. But then he did nothing. For years, he's just been doing Dance Bangla Dance, Dance India Dance. How does he need to be in BJP in order to extend that career? Is something which I don't know. I don't know why the BJP has taken him. Is he going to just stand in front of large crowds and just give dialogues from his old Hindi movies? Because in that case, I would have expected him to give the line from Cheetah, which was, in Bengal, it's a Cheetah jail theke beriyeche. সাপের ছোবল ও চিতার খাবল যেখানে পড়ায় আড়াই কিলো মাংস তুলে নেয়। Which means the cheetah has left jail, it's come out of jail, which I guess is, you know, kind of analogy for Trinamool Congress. Maybe he wants to do that. And Shaper Chobol, which again brings the snake, the bite of the snake or cheetah and the claw of the, or the claw of the cheetah, you know, when it falls upon you, it leaves with 2.5 kgs of your meat.
Or one sunny dual hand.
Yes, I wouldn't even say hand. Even Sunny Deol doesn't see the difference between a Mithun hand and Sunny Deol's hand is when Sunny Deol puts a hand upon you, he doesn't take anything from you. There's forces of a push, so you are propelled, right? So it's you leave. With Mithun Chakravarti, it's not that you leave, he takes something from you. So it's a different kind of violence.
Just aya ho to kuch to leke jaunga.
that's something else. That's Shakti Kapoor.
Right, absolutely. And
that's Shakti Kapoor.
Let's not go there.
That does not necessarily imply any kind of violence.
Is that the podcast for today then?
That is the podcast for today. So
we started with Republic Bangla, ended with Mithun Da. Does it get more Arnab than this? But that's our podcast. It's a wrap for today. Which is where I remind you that you need to support the podcast in any way you can. You can also do that at patreon.com/greatbong. And here's a bonus. I found the link to the Bengali version of the Dalal soundtrack. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. And you can listen to Gutter Gutan. What is the Bengali version of that?
Bokhom Bokhom.
Bokhom Bokhom. And
somehow, by the way, big. So the a Hindi pidgin says gutter gutter and the Bengali pidgin says bakum bakum.
So I'll be listening to that shortly. So until next time, take care. Bye-bye.